It's Wednesday, September the 29th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. With me today are Pat Leahy, Jennifer Bray, and Jack Horgan-Jones from our political staff. You are all very welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Good morning, Hugh.
And just to mention that Jack is, and this is a great thing, Jack, it's actually a sign of the return to normality, isn't it? You are out in the field reporting today, so you're somewhere in Dublin city centre. We might hear a bit of background noise there.
Yes, the Salubrious Hotel, the Ashling Hotel on the Keys. I am relaxing in its lobby and enjoying the piped-in, tinkling piano keys associated with hotel lobbies up and down the country. So apologies for any background noise, but it is fun to be back in the field actually meeting people, if not quite pressing the flesh.
Yes, indeed. Well, I'm still stuck in my box room anyway. Anyway, while there is no real single story dominating the political agenda right at the moment, there are a number of ongoing issues which have potentially significant consequences which are happening right now. And perhaps, Pat, we could touch on a few of those. We'll start with you around the whole very large subject of pre-budget discussions, because it is that time of year when those discussions start getting very pointed.
Yeah, it is. And I suppose it's a sign of the slow return. If Jack's perambulations down the Keys are one sign of it, then the return to budget wrangling is another sign of the gradual return to political normality after COVID, or as the pandemic recedes. And I think what we see in that is the return of the obligation on government to make choices that it might not find particularly comfortable. And a lot of those choices are ranged around where to spend money, what to prioritize, and what becomes, you know, once you prioritize some things, then obviously other aspects of policy become less of a priority. And that sort of process, which is governing in a microcosm, really, is always brought into pretty sharp relief at this time of the year, because the government has to make its decisions on what its spending priorities are for the coming year. Last year, we saw a massively expansionary budget where 20 billion euros was borrowed, and effectively politicians did, including but not limited to the choices that faced them with the pandemic, but politicians did what comes most naturally to politicians, which is seeking to solve problems by throwing money at them. And they did that with some abandon last year in the budget. But this year, the budget will be an awful lot tighter than that, even though the fiscal parameters have been, as we know from the summer economic statement, have been significantly expanded. And there will be a budget day package, Pascal Donoghue has told us, of 4.7 billion. That's additional spending of 4.7 billion to be announced on budget day. But even within that pretty generous envelope, and just for comparison purposes, but before last year, we had got used to budget day packages of in or about 3 billion over the previous number of years. So this is significantly larger and will be funded by continued exchequer borrowing. But it's about 4.7 billion, as Pascal Donoghue has said. However, of that, about 3.7 billion are already accounted for with previously announced spending commitments, such as the expansion in capital budgets that has been flagged, such as public sector pay increases, the cost of demographics, people getting older, more people looking for pensions, the cost of additional school places, all those sort of things that are already baked in to the government's budget plans. So that leaves about 1 billion in new budget day measures to be announced. And crowding in on that 1 billion, a very large sum, you might say, but actually small when all the demands that are being made of it are taken into account. Crowding in on that are things like the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar's commitment to a tax package that is going to take up to 500 million on the day, a welfare package that is going to take up to another 500 million on the day. And then all of a sudden, where is the rest of your room for budgetary measures that that the various ministers might like to get into the budget package? So we are going to have a large budget giveaway package on budget day. Will it be large enough to accommodate all the things that ministers want to do and that lobby groups are pushing hard for? No, it won't. It won't come within a million miles of that. And so we are back to where we started with the necessity to make budget choices.
Can I just ask you one other thing about that, Pat, before we go to the others? On that kind of macro level of that 4.7 billion, and most of it's accounted for with steady as you go, you might say, kind of measures, the pandemic's effects are not over completely yet. And there are some supports which are still going to be required to continue, aren't there, into the next fiscal year. I think, for example, of the area that I know more about, which is the area of culture and arts and entertainment, which has been slowest to recover and still suffers from scarring. So is there still a kind of a step down from the supports which have been allocated over the last 18 months that will be there in 2022 and perhaps beyond?
Yeah, so, I mean, Pascal Donoghue announced the other day that the eWIS support will continue for the month of October. So that's being operated on a sort of a month-by-month basis. But ministers have said that while the supports will be tapered off, that tapering will be gradual. So I would expect that there will be some continued pandemic support provision. But we are now in the tapering phase, and we have seen that in the pandemic unemployment payment. The process of winding that down has begun. So I think you will see some element of that within the Budget Day announcements. But by the time you get into the early part of next year, the middle of next year, it is hoped that that pandemic spending will have all but ceased and you are back to a more normal situation. But even that pandemic spending has to be held within the current budget parameters. Now, it is possible, and I wouldn't be surprised, if that 4.7 billion creeps up a bit on Budget Day. And there is always various budgetary wheezes, the metaphorical money, a couple of hundred million found down the back of the couch in government buildings. That very often happens. But the sort of open-ended spending increases amounting to a deficit of 20 billion, which is what we've seen this year and last year, those days are over, and government budgeting is going to have to take account of that.
Indeed, it's also going to have to take account, obviously, as well, of things like commitments to a much greater investment by the state in housing to address the housing crisis and various other things of that sort. But there are also, Jack, it occurs to me that there's a couple of extraordinary items in here. One of them is pandemic related. The other one isn't. One of which the government appears to have brought on itself. The other one of which has descended upon it. The second one is the MICA, and I'll go to Jen about that in a minute, the MICA crisis. But the first one is this, I'm not sure if it's a commitment or a promise or a suggestion that public servants, some or all of the public service, are entitled to some sort of bonus, additional payment, additional leave because of the sterling work that they've put in over the last year and a half. This looks like it could actually be a nightmare in the end of the day for the government, this commitment.
Yeah, I mean, is it a promise? Is it a commitment? Is it all of the above? Is it none of the above? What it is at the moment is quite kind of woolly, and no one really knows exactly what it's going to consist of. It's in the public mind, and I think in the political mind, it is tied up with the budgetary process, and the suggestion is that it will be announced on Budget Day. But the hope within government is that it won't actually come from 2022 spending. They think that they have a bit of flexibility this year as spending is coming in on or under target in some areas. And we saw that with the Department of Health for the first time in however many years yesterday, coming in on budget. And taxes are a little bit ahead of target. So they think they can finance it. It is still deficit financing, but finance it from this year's resources. So it won't eat into those kind of very finite sums that are available to Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath on Budget Day. But there the simplicity ends. And as I already described, we don't know exactly what kind of form it will take, but it looks like no matter what form it takes, it will be, to a greater or lesser extent, quite divisive. Now, this is something that the government has been looking at for quite some time. It was bubbling away in the background. Other jurisdictions have done it, and there has been a kind of high-level commitment to doing so. And it was kind of building towards maybe doing something on Budget Day. What really brought this into the foreground and made it politically problematic and a trickier proposition was a submission to the Labour Court, which flagged that acquiescing to a request from the healthcare unions to give up to 10 days extra leave to healthcare workers would cost in the region of $366 million. And Michael McGrath then said in the Dáil the following day that if that was being, if that same request was granted across the public service, it could cost up to $1 billion. So all of a sudden it moved from the abstract and, you know, a nice kind of thank you payment or thank you gesture to something that had a kind of concrete fiscal form, and quite a large concrete fiscal form. That's one problem. You get beyond that and you see a lot of Fine Gael ministers in particular over the last couple of days talking about how this could potentially be divisive. So, for example, if you were to give it to healthcare workers, when does one become a frontline healthcare worker? Is it someone who is, you know, strapped up in PPE, intubating someone who has COVID? Of course it is. But is it a hospital administrator who had to go into work every single day? And that's just within healthcare. And then we have all the other public sector unions, the teachers, the Gardaí, all of whom have reasonable claims to this. I was talking to some Fine Gael backbenchers yesterday who were suggesting that there would be people in the private sector as well who would have reasonable claims to this. So the measuring of this is really difficult, and the associated fiscal impact of it is really difficult, and the idea that it could become a divisive force as opposed to something that kind of unified and recognised the contribution of people during the pandemic is a real political risk. I don't know how they square that circle. I don't know how they kind of diffuse that. I think one possibility that has been floated is this idea that there would be a public holiday or a bank holiday. I think that gets us some way down the road to a kind of universality. But some people will feel underwhelmed, and they will point out that a lot of the frontline healthcare workers are, or those on the frontline more generally, are often those who are asked to work bank holidays anyway, and that there is an associated cost with that. I think one of the other problems that the government is facing as well is that because this is so kind of woolly and poorly formed, even though it has become a budget day discussion, there's no way they can really kind of address this, rip off the band-aid, bring a kind of resolution to this process anytime soon. So are we going to see the next kind of 10, 12, 13 days dominated by discussions and rancorous discussions about, you know, just how this bonus might be made real? And they'll be caustic and they'll be divisive. So I think this is something that the government has kind of failed to diagnose as an incoming threat, and so far has failed to kind of grab the bull by the horns, and they don't show any sign of doing so. And I don't see any easy way they're going to keep all the various camps happy and deliver something that, you know, is seen as a universal good across the board, and, you know, might deliver a kind of political bonus for the government, much less a bonus for frontline healthcare workers.
Is the traditional way of dealing with this not to kick it to a committee and await a report?
Yes, but they because they've started trailing stuff so intensively, I'm not sure that they can back out of this. I mean, the first thing to be trailed was this idea that it would be delivered on budget day, and then they trailed the idea that there'd be a public holiday, and now they're trailing the idea of vouchers, which again might be kind of, it might be easier to manage just to give, you know, a couple of hundred thousand people a couple of hundred quid in vouchers. But again, the same problem. Who do you give it to? Who doesn't get it? And now, because it's moved in the absence of any other kind of strong budget lines, even though it's not strictly speaking a budgetary measure in all likelihood, because it's moved to the centre of the budget discourse, you can't just kind of say, oh, well, you know, you guys didn't really see that, did you? And hope that nobody noticed and put it away again.
Jen, I want to get your view on this, because I'm no fan of the kind of creating artificial divisions between the private and the public sector. But the reality is, I mean, I know people who worked in really difficult circumstances as frontline health workers through the height of the pandemic, and I don't really have a problem with the idea that that should be recognised in some fashion. But I also know people in the private sector who suffered very badly as a result of the pandemic, losing their jobs or their businesses having all kinds of difficulty. And I know plenty of people who just got on okay, as I did myself, and as I know some people in the public service did too. And starting to divide the worthy from the unworthy in that is just a recipe for division and dissent, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And it's a tricky one, you're right. Like, it's tricky on the one hand to try and figure out, like Jack was outlining, exactly who would be eligible for it. But there's also a danger on the other side that if the government do go down that road of giving, you know, whether it's a 500 euro voucher, whether it's some sort of tax credit, whatever it may be, to pretty much everyone, that that could be regarded as some form of kind of auction politics almost, that you're kind of giving everything to everybody because the pressure is on at a time when we know where we are kind of financially after the pandemic. And you mentioned earlier on those pandemic schemes that have been put in place for businesses and for workers and how expensive that they've been, and how many challenges we have coming up in the next couple of years to kind of balance the books. So there is a certain element of you're watching this playing out and sort of almost seeing in the future the headlines and seeing, you know, how dangerous it could become for them if they don't kind of get a handle on it at the moment. But, you know, I'm sure that everyone else here and anyone listening would be the same. Like when you ask people what their opinion is of this bonus and who it should be made available to, everybody has a different opinion. But if we remember where this idea stemmed from, it did just come in the beginning from a suggestion that the frontline healthcare workers in, you know, working literally on the front lines, that this will be for them. And it was Leo Varadkar who went into the Dáil a couple of weeks ago and said, well, it's my opinion that if we give this to frontline healthcare workers, there are also other people who've worked very hard in the pandemic. And he singled out, one of the groups he singled out was civil servants in the Department of Social Protection and Revenue, who worked very, you know, very long hours to make sure that everybody got their PUP payments and other pandemic payments, and that they got them in time and that they weren't left out of pocket and stuck. And that's when you open the floodgates effectively. And it's very hard to get that cat back in the bag, I think. And I think this will be a big challenge for them to explain in the next couple of weeks, probably after the budget at this stage, exactly why they've come to the decision they've come to. Now, what happens after that is anyone's guess. Will the unions say, well, this is completely unfair? Will it become a massive political issue, or will people kind of agree with whatever scheme they go with in the end, whether it be limited or not? So we'll have to wait and see. But like I said, it's hard to get that sort of genie back in the bottle.
I suppose, Pat, a recurring theme of these kind of things when they blow up is at some point Leo Varadkar puts his oar in, and it's generally not in a very helpful way. And this seems to be the case here as well, you know, to move on to, you know, people in the Department of Social Welfare and other departments who may well have put in long hours, but those long hours should be recognised within the terms of their contract, either in terms of lieu time or overtime payment.
I think this is one of the points about what has now become a massive political headache for the government, is that it's entirely of their own creation. And it's specifically the pronouncements of a number of ministers, including Leo Varadkar, that have driven this. I spoke to union contacts last week when we were writing this story, and they were kind of bemused at members of the government coming out and effectively offering them things that they hadn't asked for at all. I mean, when Leo Varadkar said that in the Dáil last week, standing in for Micheál Martin at leaders' questions, when he talked about, you know, the need for, if healthcare workers were to get, or if frontline healthcare workers were to get bonuses, that civil servants in some departments should get them as well. I think that caught everyone, including those civil servants themselves, and certainly their union representatives, by surprise. So this has been driven, in the first instance, the suggestion that healthcare workers should get a bonus. But then the great expansion of that we've seen in the past week, that has been driven by the pronouncements of ministers. And I suspect what is ultimately likely to happen here, or the solution that will be found to it, will please nobody. The bonus will be not expansive enough, whether it comes in the shape of a voucher or cash or a few days extra holidays, it will not be sufficiently generous to keep the people who are getting it happy, but it will still drive everybody who doesn't get it quite mad with envy and rage about it. I mean, no more than anybody else's, my Twitter timeline is reflective of nothing at all, other than possibly of the people who are on it. But the rage I saw from both pro and anti-teacher sides on it this morning, if it is anything at all to go by, it certainly means that the government has created quite, and the government has done exactly that. It has created quite a political storm for itself.
So that is a self-inflicted problem, Jen. The other problem is not self-inflicted. It has come to the door of the government on dint of the rising tide of protests coming out of Donegal and the Northwest over the impact of the mica crisis on thousands of houses that have been built, and other buildings too, that have been built over the last 20 years or more, many of which are going to have to be demolished and rebuilt. And a system has been set up, a report is being prepared. You write about this in some detail in today's Irish Times, and it looks like there's trouble ahead.
Yeah, there could be trouble ahead. I mean, if you cast your mind back a little bit to just before the summer, obviously there's a lot going on before the summer recess, but one of the big issues we were seeing was increasing numbers of protests in relation to this mica issue, which, you know, these are the defective blocks that are causing houses to crumble in counties like Donegal, Mayo and other counties too. And those protests really did build in size and in volume, and they organised to such a degree that the politicians, and particularly in those counties that are affected, and they really did start to feel that pressure. And the government became under, I would call it, acute pressure then to basically act on the demand which protesters have, which is, instead of 90% redress, to put that up to 100%. A lot of protesters and affected homeowners were saying they literally could not afford the price of remediating or rebuilding their house with the costs that they were being left with. And some of the stories, many people have seen them, you know, they are truly awful and it is horrible to see. But the problem for the government was then at that stage to figure out, how do we deal with this? How can we afford this? So what they decided to do just before the summer recess was, just after one of those protests, the Minister for Housing, Dara O'Brien, met some of the campaigners. He brought them into the Dáil. There was pictures of that. And afterwards, he announced that he was going to set up a working group. And this, you know, the sort of the boast almost at the time was that, well, this isn't just your average officials talking to officials. This is going to be a group with people from the local authority. Yes, department officials, obviously, but also those protesters are representatives of the affected homeowners. So they were saying, you know, we're bringing these campaigners into the process. This is why it's going to be different. And they kind of viewed it as taking the heat out of the subject, which is, you know, in politics, very important. And also giving them, buying them time, also very important. So they got, you know, through the summer, there was a couple of issues in the summer when some of the representatives stepped down. They felt that the discussions were going in a direction that they wouldn't be able to support. And those that remained did stay within those talks. Now what we found has happened is that working group, which is looking at redress and the previous scheme, how to improve it, how to include more people, how to make sure people don't face those massive bills, that's due to report either today or tomorrow. And there's real tensions. What I've been told is on that group between the department officials and the campaigners, let's just say things have not been going well. It appears to be absolutely no love lost between the two sides. They're coming from two completely opposing positions. The positions of the officials is that they cannot support at this moment in time a scheme which is basically unlimited redress up to 100%. And whereas obviously we know the views of the campaigners, they're supposed to come together to have this report that they all put their name to. And that may not be the case because those campaigners say they haven't actually seen the report, despite the fact that they have their final meeting this evening with Dara O'Brien. Now, what becomes of that? Dara O'Brien was on the radio this morning saying, look, if they need more time to read it when we send it to them, that won't be a problem. It will delay things a little bit. But if that's what they need, that's what we'll do. The big problem isn't necessarily who sees a report and who doesn't, although it is very important for those involved. The big problem is the cost. And, you know, the what the politicians have been saying is we cannot have a scheme that is basically open to everybody at any cost because of the effect that would have on the taxpayer and the exposure that would give the taxpayer. And what I've been told by people in the department is that if we get down to the crux of the issue, what is the exact problem here? Why can't we just give them the money to rebuild their homes, etc.? It's because we're talking about different homes here. You might have an estate in Mayo where they're semi-D homes and they're all, you know, within a certain square footage. They'll all cost basically the same amount and there's relatively few problems in terms of that. But you also might have one-off homes in Donegal, which could be beyond 4,000 square feet and are a completely different ballgame altogether. And the question is, should the taxpayer fund redress for both of those types of homes when it was, you know, each homeowner's decision, albeit it was not their fault what happened, to buy those houses or to build those kinds of houses or whatever. There's a second thing as well, is what else should be included in the scheme? Should there be a 40-year state guarantee? And the reason why the campaigners want this is because if they go in and do the remedial work and then cracks appear after that, obviously they're going to have a problem. Then they're going to have a problem with insurance. They're going to have other problems down the line. And, you know, there's a couple of other things they want. But what I will finally say is another issue of contention, the smallest things you wouldn't, you know, the things you wouldn't even think of. For example, the B or energy rating of a home. Should these houses be upgraded or rebuilt to a higher standard of energy rating? Should that be funded by the taxpayer? Or should they be built to the rating that they were at previously or what is necessary? I mean, that's a debate. Should these homes have new kitchens installed? Should they have new bathrooms installed? Or should those homeowners try and bring in their previous suites of, you know, kitchens, bathrooms, fittings, even windows and doors? And the question is, well, this existing scheme now says that you should bring in everything you previously had and reinstall it. Whereas what the homeowners are saying is that builders are coming in and saying, there's no way are we putting that, you know, bathroom suite out in, you know, storage for 1 year when it chips and seizes up. You know, we're not going to be able to reinstall that. So these are all the issues at play that they'll have to figure out. And the government say there has to be a cap and the campaigners say there can't be.
I mean, there's some real issues there. I should say, I know some people who are directly affected by this, and it's an absolutely awful situation to be in if your family home is crumbling around you and you don't know what you're going to do. And there are real difficulties with people then saying, but I have these 20-year-old windows that I was going to replace in 2 years anyway, and now they're insisting that I put them back in the house. So there's all of that complexity. But there is also the fact that in rural parts of the country and in Donegal as elsewhere, there are these McMansions that you see. And the idea that you're going to rebuild them at a cost of, you know, probably $500,000 or more, while you're dealing with complete housing crises where people can't even get a shoebox to live in other parts of the country, is again a little bit like the previous subject, potentially divisive.
Yeah, it's very difficult. And this is where the crux of the issue is, I think. Well, one of the many issues, but the big one. And I've talked to kind of some backbenchers and in Fine Gael, because you know how Fine Gael have been very strong, the backbenchers in particular, and insisting that, because they're really feeling the heat, you know, they're getting it in the neck from their constituents. So they've been very insistent. And I've asked them, you know, during private conversations, what about this point? What about these houses? You know, what about the exposure to the taxpayer? And the thing that I keep getting told or hearing back is that we should deal with these homeowners on a case-by-case basis. But what does that actually mean? You know, you can't go to the Department of Public Expenditure and say, okay, we're going to need north of 1.5 billion, which is going to cost, that's the minimum at this stage, what's going to cost. But possibly much, much more. We don't know, because we're going to be dealing with things on a case-by-case basis. I think the officials and government don't believe that just will not cut the mustard. So what we'll find out, hopefully, either later on this evening or Thursday morning, will be what those officials and department have recommended. What's looking likely is that in that report, it might be split into two. Here's what the officials think. Here's what the department officials, here's what the campaigners, here's their view. Here you go, minister, you go off and make this political decision now. And, you know, good luck to you, basically, and Godspeed. And that's what Dara Byrne will have to do, effectively. I think he will either have to disappoint and enrage, like you said, these homeowners who you, some of whom you know, and a lot of whom I've spoken to over the last couple of days, and it is absolutely awful what they're having to live with, and there will be political consequences for him doing that, or else he'll have to go and override his officials and somehow, you know, play a game of arm wrestle with the Department of Public Expenditure to get all the money that he needs. And I don't envy him trying to square that circle.
And the thing with this one, of course, is time waits for no man on this one, because these houses are crumbling around people as we speak.
Yeah, exactly. They are. And, you know, there have been homes that have been, so, you know, there is an existing scheme at the moment, 90%. There have been homes that have been demolished a couple of months ago. The first few under that scheme, I think in April, they were demolished, and the outer leaf, as they call it, has been rebuilt. And there's issues even now with those houses, because the inner part of the house still has these mica blocks, and insurance companies, etc., saying, well, we're actually not going to insure you because you still have mica inside your home. So even those homes that have already been part of that process may have to re-enter the process. I mean, it's so complicated, and it's so devastating for those people to literally be in a house where the bricks are crumbling around you. But you have to also look at it from the point of view of taxpayers too. It's only fair to ask what is the extent of what people should be funding.
Right. But I get the impression that these are obviously big challenges, but they seem to be less of a challenge to our current Taoiseach and leader of Fine Gael, Leo Varadkar, than they might have been a few years in the past when he was seen as a bit of a fiscal hawk on the right wing of Fine Gael, not keen for the state to be too heavy on the largesse and keen to focus more, in as much as is possible in this country, on tax cuts. But that old Leo Varadkar, the one who won the Fine Gael election against the Just Society candidate, Simon Coveney, seems to have been replaced by a much more social democratic, I spend it when you've got it, kind of a Leo Varadkar.
Well, a period of time in government tends to convince politicians of the power of government. And of course, the power of government comes from its vast resources. But to exercise that power, you have to be willing to spend those vast resources. And, you know, I suppose people can make up their own minds about the conversion of Leo Varadkar, if that is what it is. I know that Brendan Howlin, after his experience in the Labour Fine Gael government between 2011 and 2016, used to observe to his colleagues, perhaps only half in jest, that Labour's greatest achievement in government was to make Leo Varadkar into a social democrat. That might be slightly overstating it, but I wrote about this at the weekend, contrasting some of the sort of things that Leo Varadkar used to say about the recklessness of making incontinent promises of spending in response to representations from every interest group in advance of the budget, with the sort of things that he's been saying recently. And the contrast wasn't very hard to see. It is a perfectly respectable and coherent philosophy of government, and one which, you know, many European countries have built their stable and successful societies on, that idea of a big and well-resourced state that has a big part to play in the economy and in people's own economic lives, you know, that social democratic idea. And it's also a perfectly respectable and coherent alternative for people to say that the size of the state should be minimized in as far as possible to stimulate economic activity and thus create a larger pie, as it were. But I'm not sure how defensible it is to maintain both these things at the one time. And certainly I think Leo Varadkar could be accused of that recently, because he's been promising tax cuts, but also significant spending increases. And, you know, if that's the story of many Irish budgets, then the extent to which he has done so on this budget is something that has certainly caught me by surprise. And going back to part of our conversation earlier about the bonuses for public service workers, it was Leo Varadkar who escalated that in the Dáil last week, as we've already referred to, when he spoke about the need for many civil servants to benefit from these bonuses if and when they come. So, you know, I mean, you could look at this, and I suppose supporters of the Taoiseach would do so, as many of the things that he has spoken about, and he gave a speech to IBEC last week, which I thought, and I observed at the weekend, wouldn't have been out of place in at a Labour Party conference, talking about, you know, the need for statutory sick pay, flexible working, union recognition, minimum wage, living wage, all that sort of stuff. Again, you know, all pretty mainstream ideas, but not something with which I think we would have associated Leo Varadkar in the past. Now, as I say, supporters of his might say, you know, this is very much the kind of mainstream of European politics, and it is. But I think that there are few people who are as good as Leo Varadkar at sort of meta-political communication in Irish politics today. And I think that he is well aware that this will be perceived by people as a shift to the centre, if not the centre-left. And I think what he is doing is reacting to the fact that, as we've observed here before, the sort of centre of gravity of Irish politics has moved to the left in recent years. That move wasn't started by the pandemic, but I think it was accelerated by it. And I think he is moving to attune himself and his party with that.
So there is a broader question in relation to that, Jack, taking on board everything that Pat says in the Irish context. And I mean, that broader picture is that in other European countries and in the United States, partly in the wake of the pandemic, but also perhaps in a kind of delayed reaction to the austerity policies in the post-crash years, there's been a significant rethink of what's the correct approach to national economies and fiscal policy. And we see it with Joe Biden. We see it to an extent in the shift to the left in the German election that we saw at the weekend as well. But still in all those countries, in Germany with all its consensus and all the rest of that, and in other European countries, there is still a party that represents what used to be called the traditional fiscal conservative position. And in Ireland, that party was always Fine Gael, I think. And while accepting what Pat says about the centre shifting to the left, is there any possibility at all that some people who like those traditional Fine Gael policies, which are less visible at the moment, might feel that there's no party looking after them on the Irish political scene? There's no party that will describe itself as fiscally conservative in Ireland. There probably hasn't been for a long, long time, actually.
No, probably not since the PDs, and even they were taken by the excesses of the Celtic Tiger as well. Look, I think that the hope that Leo Varadkar would have and that the Fine Gael leadership would have would be that they can possibly accommodate both, be a kind of broad church. And I think that Pat is right. I think that the shift from Varadkar, what I've previously called a kind of leftward shimmy, is a more reactive thing than proactive. I think that he's reacting to that shift in the centre ground. He's reacting to a kind of mood in the populace that, you know, sees a bigger place for state provision. And, you know, he's reacting to probably a threat manifest by Sinn Féin to the greatest extent, but also, you know, he's trying to perhaps mop up votes that might be kind of social democratic, either in going to the Social Democrats or Labour or the Greens. And, you know, it'll be a challenge for him to maintain that kind of, you know, more traditional Fine Gael outlook while also reaching back into the kind of Declan Costello Just Society Fine Gael and trying to kind of ride both bikes at the same time. I think that is a very real challenge. And you see that. And you see that if you kind of closely parse his public pronouncements on things, even like MICA. So, for example, last week after Cabinet, he was part of a ministerial triptych that did a doorstep, and he was talking about, you know, we have to be very careful here around MICA. This is taxpayers' money, after all. The government only has the money that we take from you, the taxpayers, which is very much in the traditional Leo Varadkar kind of instinctively conservative small government mode, right? And then he got, I think, a very clear message at the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party meeting that week, where 15 speakers apparently came out in favour of more or less 100% redress. And he had to kind of rapidly revise that position and almost kind of point the finger over Fianna Fáil and say, well, you know, it's McGrath and Deeper and O'Brien and Housing who have to come up with the solutions here. So I think that there is that tension there. And I think that, you know, I don't want to say the mask slips, but, like, you know, he is instinctively on that kind of small government end. And I think that it's certainly a challenge for him to try and please both masters there, and whether it's one that he can do effectively. I think Pat is right about his kind of instinctive, you know, political mastery of I think meta-political commentary was the phrase that Pat had. But whether that washes, I'll borrow it.
Feel free to use it, Jack.
But whether that washes with voters come election time, and whether it kind of coalesces into a single coherent message around a manifesto is difficult as well, because that's where all those divisions become sharpened and where you have to actually say to voters, we're for this but not for that.
Yeah, there's a couple of funny things that strike me about this, Jen. One is we've spent so much time over the last few months talking about the challenge facing Fianna Fáil because it doesn't know what it is and which way it's facing and who its constituencies are and all that kind of stuff. And you could say to some extent that the same is true of Fine Gael on the basis of what I'm hearing there, from Pat and Jack. And the other thing is the whether it's meta or not, this notion of Leo Varadkar as some kind of philosopher savant of the political scene is not borne out by his actual performance at actual elections. So I just wonder, is he leading them in the right direction from the purely political pragmatic point of view of maximising their success at the next election.
Yeah, yeah. And if you think about it, you know, the last time Fine Gael had this conversation in the sort of, you know, existential sense, I suppose, will be during the leadership campaign when we had Simon Coveney, who was talking about sort of the soul of Fine Gael, you know, and about a more just and inclusive society and you know, talking about being more compassionate and all that kind of stuff. And that's kind of the road that he was going down. Obviously, he was very, very popular with the grassroots. Leo Varadkar, on the other hand, was sort of talking about, as we know, a controversial sort of campaigns that he had would be welfare cheats, cheat us all. He wanted to represent, you know, people who get up early in the morning, you know, very much speaking to kind of that pro-enterprise, pro-worker sort of policy. But if you look at how he's changed over the years, you know, he I would wonder how much of it is to do, you know, and it was mentioned there about the impact of Sinn Féin. So they've been very strong in criticising him for his welfare cheats, cheat us all, and for being sort of anti, you know, those workers, etc. And for being sort of, I suppose, sometimes they would accuse him of being a bit of a snob, in fact.
Yeah, and anti-working class, something like the leaflets that went out in the Dublin Bay South by-election on the eve of the vote.
Yes, exactly. And I think that he will have felt that down through the years, and those criticisms will have stung somewhat, because I did think they landed eventually with people. And I wonder how much of it now is him trying to recalibrate a little bit. And, you know, Pat mentioned the IBEX speech last week, talking about just those things, you know, a just, inclusive society. And then Pat mentioned, you know, statutory sick pay, the living wage, all this kind of stuff. It is definitely a shift. Now, having said that, there are other things that he has, you know, I remember this idea. So what they're talking about in the budget now is the 500 million euro tax package. And the vast majority of that will be taken up with indexation, which indexation is basically linking your welfare payment to like inflation or the consumer price index. And the first time I heard this idea was actually from Leo Varadkar at Glenties, around, God, how many years ago would that be now? I'm actually scared to even think, but let's say at least 5 years ago. So this is very much something that he has been, I wouldn't say championing, but that's something that he has wanted to do. So policy-wise, he's still on the same page, but what he's saying is quite different.
Yeah, I wonder. Not a philosopher king in my eyes anyway. Listen, I want to touch on one other thing, Pat, before we go, because it strikes me that if we took this podcast, or indeed all our podcasts, around this historical moment in Irish political history and stuck them in a canister and stuck them in the ground and somebody took them out in 10 or 20 years' time, that the thing they might be looking for is the most significant moment that was happening at the moment is the end or the imminent end of the 12.5% corporation tax, which Fintan O'Toole this week described in the Irish Times as a fetish rather than a policy. Whatever one may think of it, it does look as if it's time for this world maybe drawing to a close.
Oh, I think that is not unlikely. Yeah, I mean, we've been writing about this for some time, that the government is, as ever, you know, referring back to our earlier conversations, is stuck between, you know, not a good option and a bad option, but between two options, and it has to decide which is the least bad of them. The position, as I understand it at the moment, is that if the OECD agrees to change its document from at least 15%, quote unquote, to 15%, then the government will reluctantly sign up to it. On the other hand, and that is, there is very considerable diplomatic and political outreach, I'm told, going on at the moment to try and secure that change. And people involved in that process have said to me, when I have suggested some scepticism that the 130 countries, including the world's biggest economies that are signed up to at least 15%, will move to 15% at Ireland's behest, it is put to me that it is really important for EU unity, and that is, you know, that's a very large consideration for both the OECD and the G7 and G20, which are also important players in all this. I think that's probably a nailed down certainty at the moment, that if it is if that change is made, then Ireland will sign up. The really big decision will come for Ireland is if that change isn't made. If the OECD, which is meeting at the end of next week to discuss this, and there's a G20 summit at the end of this month, And obviously there'll be many discussions in advance of that. But if they don't make that change, if they stick with at least 15%, thus in Irish eyes opening up the possibility that the 15% is banked and further increases in corporation tax are down the line, then that's going to be a much harder choice for the Irish government to make, because the choice will be at that stage between standing outside an overwhelming international consensus or effectively giving up on the 12.5%. Fintan refers to it as a fetish. I think it's more like a sort of a shibboleth here in Ireland that means something very specific to a particular community. And if that is done without the certainty, if that rate is given, the 12.5% rate is given up without the certainty that it will stick at 15%, then I think that is a very significant and potentially far-reaching move for the government to take. Even aside from the immediate prospect of a loss of corporation tax revenue, and let us not forget at this time of in the political calendar of budget making, when we're talking about, you know, €1 billion discretionary choices on budget day for the Minister for Finance, that his department has estimated that getting rid of 12.5% will cost Ireland in the region of €2 billion every year taken out of tax receipts. So this is, I think, one of the furthest reaching decisions that I can remember an Irish government having to take. And I think you're right that if we put all these podcasts into a canister and looked at them in 20 years' time, although I think, frankly, we have data centers for that now, Hugh, I think that is that is the thing that we will be looking for.
Yeah, those data centers we know are likely to cause us power cuts in the not too distant future, which is probably a subject for another podcast. But actually, I just want to follow up with you on one question on that, because the difficulty for Pascal Donoghue and the Irish government, isn't it? They face two ways. There's the question of the relationship within the EU countries, in particular within that OECD debate, and the question whether Ireland really can stand alone on that issue if all the weight is brought to bear. But equally, most of that corporation tax that we're getting, and that's funding so many of the other things that we were talking about today, is coming from American corporations. So you're looking west as well to what's likely to happen in Washington and what looks increasingly like a faltering Biden presidency, which may not be able to achieve some of the things it wants to do in terms of corporation tax, which would have an immediate knock-on effect on what happens in Ireland.
Yeah, and Irish officials that I've spoken to are watching what's going on in Capitol Hill and in the White House very, very keenly. But my own view is that if Biden doesn't get these reforms through to part fund at least his massive $3.5 billion stimulus package, then his presidency is effectively over. And I think that the Democrats on the Hill will be able to see that too. So I think it is likely that he has some measure of success. He won't, like any other president, get everything he wants, but he will, I think, get enough to carry a large amount of this through, and that will then throw it back to the Irish government, whether or not they succeed in getting that change in the OECD text that they've sought.
And I think a lot of those events in Washington are going to become much clearer just over the next 2 or 3 weeks. It's crunch time over there as well. We keep an eye on that too. But we will leave that for today. Thanks very much to Jen, to Jack and to Pat, and to our producer, Suzanne Brennan, and our engineer, JJ Vernon. We're going to be back with you next week. Remember, you can mail us with your thoughts or your questions at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. Look forward to seeing you then.